in Any Woman's Blues. This is not the appearance of Isadora Wing, is it?
Yeah, but I'm trying to kill her off.
You didn't.
You may have noticed that I'm always trying to kill her off, but I can't seem to get rid of her.
Tell
she
me about
swims back from the Solomon Sea.
Well, tell me about Isadora Wing and her progressions through your books.
Well, you know, I wanted to get rid of Isadora Wing. I don't think that there is an author in the world who's created a character that becomes more famous than that author who doesn't want to kill that character. I'm sure that Nabokov wanted to kill Lolita. He once remarked very testily, "Lolita is famous, not I." And it's just a natural feeling when the character overtakes your life.
Doyle wanted to kill Sherlock Holmes.
And did, right? He did.
Theoretically, I think he came back in a subsequent story.
You see, I maintain you cannot kill a fictional character. They are unkillable. I mean, because the rules that apply to flesh and blood don't apply to them. So it is perfectly possible to kill them off and have them come back. I mean, if I can have Shakespeare turn up as a lover in Serenissima, why can't I have Isadora Wing come back to life at the end of this novel? But Isadora had become so much my alter ego in the eyes of my public that I wanted to create another character to be the bearer of this book. And I wanted her to be an artist because I wanted to set the book in the craziness of the art world in the 80s, which I felt was a kind of paradigm for life in the 80s.
And yet although Leela in the new book is an artist and Isadora is a writer, there is not a lot of difference between the two women, is there?
Well, there's not a lot of difference in the sense that they both pursue a creative kind of work. But in a way, Leela is a rebel and has been a rebel all her life. She comes from a dysfunctional family, an alcoholic family, a mother who was clearly mad and has been dead for 20 years when the novel starts, a father who was a silversmith on 8th Street. And the major difference that I see between her and Isadora is that Isadora comes from an affluent family, and Leela comes from a sort of hard-scrabble, poor family. And therefore, when Leela comes to a point where she's ready to throw away everything she's built out of poverty for this beautiful young man, it is much more poignant. Because money means to her what it means to people who've worked their way up from nothing. She's like a kind of Barbara Streisand of the art world. So when a woman like that is willing to give away everything to a beautiful young man, it shows you to a certain extent the depths of the addiction, her addiction to him. And that was essential. If I had made Isadora my heroine, I wouldn't have had that element, which was very important to me. Also the rebelliousness in Leela, which identifies with the rebelliousness in Dart. She's a rebel. She's always been a rebel. She's always been, in a way, an addict. And she's always been a shit disturber, someone who likes to kick things up and make trouble. Isadora is more of the good girl pretending to be the bad girl. I do see a difference between them as characters, but one of the things that interested me in the book was to show Isadora commenting on Leela. And in a sense, I think that I partake of all the characters in the book. I am, in a sense, Leela. I am, in a sense, Isadora. I am, in a sense, Carol Fleischman Stanger, PhD, this boring feminist scholar who comments on the book and gets everything wrong because she has no sense of humor.
Yeah, you, a writer does have to be part of virtually every character, even characters who are antagonists, like some of the male characters in the book.
Dart, I identify a lot with Dart, the heartbreaker, the charmer, the person who feels so insecure inside that he has to make everybody fall in love with him. That I can identify with a lot. There was a part of that in me, you know, love me, love me, love me, love me, because I don't really love myself.
Yeah, we all know people like that. We like them and we want to kick them at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
But back to Isadora, you have this ambivalence. You said you wanted to kill her off, which you did at the beginning, but you didn't quite do it at the end, so you're not quite ready for the coup de grace, are you?
Not quite ready. But I think that, you know, I have created, in a sense, a gallery of characters, a rogues gallery of characters, and I have special feelings about all of them. My favorite of all my characters was for a long time Fanny Hackabat Jones, because she's very plucky and she always comes back no matter what happens. I like Layla for the same reason. She's plucky. She springs back up no matter what you do to her. No matter what she does to herself, she's a survivor and a fighter. And I like that about her. It's true of Isadora, too. I guess that's what I admire in people. Not never to make mistakes, because we all make mistakes because we're all stumbling human beings. But to make the mistakes, to admit to the mistakes, and then to bounce back and get up and go for one more round.
Now, Layla is addicted, as you say, to dart. She's addicted to booze. She's addicted to sex. I can see being addicted to another person to a degree. I can see being addicted to booze. But how does one become addicted to sex?
I think probably because sex is an anodyne that drowns out the pain of life, like all these other substances. It can become the endorphin rush, you know, that cures the backache and the headache and all of that. It's the same endorphin rush, whether you get it from eating chocolate, having an orgasm, drinking a glass of wine. It turns out that in the synapses of the brain, it feels the same. So people can get addicted to all of these things in precisely the same way. Another character in Any Woman's Blues, Lionel Schaefer, gets his endorphin rush from taking over companies and doing leveraged buyouts. And certainly we've seen a lot of that in the 80s. I mean, there are a lot of people who get high on money and greed and stomping on other people and issuing junk bonds. So that can be an addiction, too. All of these things can be addictions. It sort of depends on how they're used. I'm not saying that sex per se is an addiction, but I'm saying that it can be used addictively, just as money can be used addictively.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've always thought about it as an organic necessity. So that is something, booze is something voluntary.
But we can abuse any substance. My point is, we can abuse any substance. And we have, over the last 10 years and longer, lived in a society in which abuse of substances is not even considered abnormal. We live in a society that is so materialistic that people are told, take the next thing into your body. You know, whether it's the next boyfriend, the next drug, the next bar of chocolate, the next glass of wine, and you will feel better. Get the bigger car and you will feel better. Well, you find out you get these things and you don't feel better. Because what you're hungering for is a spiritual thing. It isn't really a physical thing or material thing at all. And I think one of the points of Any Woman's Blues, which is a kind of moral fable for the times, as I see it, is that people have to find that, fill that empty place inside in a different way, not through more and more and more and more stuff, whatever that stuff is. And I see this enormous spiritual hunger in America that is unfed, and that's why people are trooping off into the back door of churches, to Al-Anon, to AA, to Overeaters Anonymous, to Adult Children of Alcoholics, to Love Addicts Anonymous. You can make fun of it. You can joke about it. You can say codependency is a trendy term, all of which is true. But what is the hunger that leads people to search in this way? The hunger is a real hunger, and it is the story of our time.
Yeah, these people are desperate to alter something negative in their lives, and they don't know how to do it. So
I think they're hungering for spirit. I think what Layla says in Any Woman's Blues, I learned that we are not physical beings going through spiritual experiences, but we are spiritual beings going through human experiences so that we may grow. And I think it's essential that human beings see themselves as spiritual creatures who for a time inhabit the body, because only through that time in the body can you know certain things, but then who move on. I don't know what the realms we move on to are. I mean, I haven't been there. But I know that what is unique about human beings is that we bear this spark of divinity, and that we are more than just matter. And whether you see it in a pagan or pantheist way and see God in a tree or a cloud, or whether you see God in the Madonna, or whether you see God in a patriarchal father God, doesn't matter to me. But that you understand that you partake of some divine feeling, it seems to me essential in order for people to go on living happily with themselves. There isn't a single society that has prospered without some concept of spirit. When a society becomes totally materialistic and loses touch with spirit, end of the Roman Empire is a perfect example. Its decline is not far behind. Its decay is not far behind. And it is always replaced.
Well, I don't know. There are plenty of reasonable people who do not believe in a divine presence. And I was going to ask you, Layla goes to Alcoholics Anonymous, and there seems to be a lot of dependency on God, or at least a higher being in Alcoholics Anonymous. How does someone who goes to a program like that, say he is a non-believer, reconcile this non-belief with the program?
I think that many people who are very skeptical about God, because they've learned about God from organized religion, sometimes they come to believe that God exists in these people supporting and helping each other, that this network of people loving and supporting and approving of each other is, in a sense, God. Or they come to believe that community service is God, because it brings out the best in us. In other words, they find something healing, perhaps not in an organized religious way. But we all know, this is all very old wisdom. I mean, what people are getting in 12-step programs is not new. There's nothing in these 12-step programs that is not in the teachings of Buddha, or in the Sermon on the Mount, or in Lao Tzu, for example. I mean, it's there in all these places. But it's just sort of old wine in new bottles. It's a new way of coming at these eternal verities. You feel bad, help another person. Take stock of yourself at the end of the day. If you do something that hurts somebody, make amends. This is not new stuff.
But you can, I would assume that someone in the program who is a non-believer can pick and choose a little bit in the way that, say, a Catholic picks and chooses elements of his religion that are practical. There are so many impractical elements of Catholicism that if they were applied, the world would be so overpopulated it would be ridiculous. So most Catholics that I talk to ignore the silly aspects of Catholicism, but still stay within the church. So it would seem to me that someone in an Alcoholics Anonymous program can also pick and choose in the same way, couldn't they?
They don't have to find God in the way the other people in the group find God. You know, they find God as they understand God, which could mean God in oneself, God in the group, God as the spark of divinity that propels one to do creative work. For me, God has always been synonymous with the muse. That for me,
well,
that was
writer.
My right. That was my vision of God. For Layla, in Any Woman's Blues, she sits at her easel and opens her palms and waits for an inspiration to make a painting. That seems to me a perfectly okay way for an artist to experience God. But what is interesting to me about the decade of the 80s that we've just come through, or we're in the last year of actually, is that we've had this enormous materialism on the one hand, and then we've had this vast movement of spirituality on the other. And what Any Woman's Blues depicts is the interrelationship between those two things. The wild materialism, the billionaires at the ball, the art dealers making money and trying to buy paintings at a discount, the artists making a fortune and using it to go out and get stoned and drunk and kill themselves on motorcycles, and at the same time all these people trooping off to churches to go in the back door and say the Lord's Prayer. And that to me encapsulates the dilemmas and the contradictions of the decade of the 80s.
Well, in reading Any Woman's Blues, I'm not certain that Layla was an alcoholic, although she had a drinking problem to a degree, but I also have this feeling that drinking to a certain degree is habit. You know, she did fall on hard times. She, with Dart, who was certainly an inappropriate young man for her, and their relationship, no wonder it was traumatic. And no wonder that she might have began drinking. But I don't see any sign in the book that she was a long-term alcoholic.
No,
I think she only goes to two or three meetings in the book.
I see her as a woman who drinks because her man drugs because her man drugs, rather than as an alcoholic. But then that's a very common syndrome among lovers who are very codependent, and particularly among women. Men do that too sometimes. I mean, they take up the substances of the person they're in love with. But it's much more common for a woman, like Layla in Any Woman's Blues, to take up the substance because the lover does it. I mean, you don't want to say to this person in a romantic moment, no more wine, no more pot. Many women feel that their lover will leave them if they don't partake with him of whatever it is he's doing.
Well, it's always good to get high together.
Right.
I mean, well, that's true.
But
it's very awkward for one person to get high and the other stays sober, and somehow they don't mesh.
But I think that's Layla's. I mean, I always say Layla is addicted to the man, and the man is addicted to the substance, because it seems clear to me that she's not so much an alcoholic as she is a man junkie.
But this, what I just said, was borne out by her relationship. I can't remember all the titles,
yes.
with other men who would become. I remember there was one scene. I can't remember the man's name. But he's driving wildly. They're going up through one place in Connecticut to another, and he's drunk, and she doesn't like the odor, and she doesn't like the feeling. They go into a bar. There are the teeny boppers around it. You know, remember the scene? And she's, in effect, disgusted because she's sober, I guess, and he's not. And it just doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's possible to, if you have a good relationship with somebody, you don't both have to do the same substances. If your relationship is based on you're getting it's blacked out, then maybe you have to examine the relationship. If you have nothing in common with the person when you're not drunk or on pot, if the sex is only good when you're stoned, I think you have to examine the relationship. I really think that that's probably an indication that there isn't as much between you as you thought.
Now, Erica, this S&M club in Manhattan, can you tell me the address? where is this place?
Listen, I was asked when I was doing my 10-city tour through the United States, somebody said, Erica, do you do S&M? And I said, sure, I go to the Anvil every night. And the person looked at me and said, the Anvil's been closed for years. Obviously,
I don't think they let you in any event.
Was it a men's, exclusively men's?
The Anvil?
Yeah.
Anvil was a notorious homosexual club.
Well, let me just tell you that I will disappoint my loyal readers no matter how I answer this question if I say that I do S&M all the time. And some will be disappointed and outraged. And if I say I don't, some will be disappointed and outraged. Let's just say that I've done a lot of research.
Leave it as an air of mystery around this one. When Fear of Flying came out in 1973, it was really an enormous success. Do you ever feel under pressure to constantly have to top yourself?
I think we all do. I mean, I think that's the tragedy of fame in America. You know, you're only as good as your last hit, and they're ready to throw you in the garbage if you don't top your last performance. I mean, it's a very sick view of creative work, let's face it. But being Americans, we're all infected by it. And so we feel we have to top our last success. Sure, I felt pressured by that. If I look at it rationally with my sane mind, which I'm always searching for, with varying degrees of success, right, I realize that a book like Fear of Flying that got into the Guinness Book of World Records is not likely to happen every time. First of all, paperbacks don't sell in the numbers they did in the 70s anymore, because the hardcover book is now discounted in the chains. And the paperback book in the early 70s cost $1.95. Nowadays, the paperback book costs $6. The discounting of the chains means that the spread between the paperback book and the hardcover book is not that great, which in turn means that paperback books don't sell in the numbers that they did then. So a book that sells 6 million copies in America and 4 million around the world, as Fear of Flying did, is not as likely today, because of the realities of the business having changed, Nonetheless, the expectation on the part of my publishers is always that I will top the last book. And that's impossible.
That's
for
really
an artist.
Unfair, too.
It's unfair, but it's a sort of American kind of thinking about success. Look at poor Michael Jackson. He's got it worse.
Let me tell you a story. I was interviewing Sloan Wilson a while ago. He was the man, of course, who wrote, when he was very young, his first book, The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit. Enormous success. Popular motion picture. He had a couple of fairly good successes after that, A Summer Place and I can't remember the titles of some of the others. Anyway, he was sitting where you are, and I asked him, because he lives in Florida now, and he still turns out a book every 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And they're rarely even reviewed today. And so I asked him, how do you feel? You know, here you have this enormous success with The Man and the Gray Flannel Suit, and none of your other books has ever reached that plateau, and how do you feel? He said, I'm very proud. He said that I'm the man who wrote The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit. He says, if that's the only book I'm ever remembered for, I'm pleased that I was able to do it and I brought so much pleasure to people. And I thought that was a wonderful thing for him to say. Yeah, but he's a professional. He still turns out books. He still writes. He's still hoping for another hit. And it hasn't.
But you see, if you judged yourself, ultimately, a person can't sit alone in a room for 3.5 years writing a book without having come to some spiritual peace. I mean, that's the great thing about being a writer. If you believe that the numbers tell you who you are, then you've got to believe that Danielle Steele is a better writer than James Joyce. Because Ulysses was printed in a first edition of 750 copies. I am proud to own one of those 750 copies. It was hard to come by and expensive to buy. Now, Danielle Steele's latest book is printed in an edition of 1 million copies. Is she a better writer than James Joyce? I don't think so. So somewhere you've got to have that historical perspective and remember that the numbers don't tell you alone what something is worth. Emily Dickinson never was published in her lifetime. I would give this right hand to have written the poems of Emily Dickinson. I think they're that important. In her time, nobody knew who she was. I think that if you're a writer, it means that you spend a lot of time alone in that meditative experience known as writing. And the best thing about being a writer is that hopefully you get some spiritual wisdom out of that. Hopefully your readers get it too when the book is published and the circle gets completed. And I say at the end of Any Woman's Blues, this is my prayer and my love letter to you, and I really mean it. I really mean that my books are a prayer and a love letter to my readers. But they're also a prayer for myself. And what is the prayer for? The prayer is for a kind of wisdom and a kind of distance and a kind of take on the world. I want my soul, when it leaves this mortal plane, to be more evolved than it was when it entered it. And one of the ways I do that is through my writing. And I try to share that soul evolution with my readers. I hope that they get that from Any Woman's Blues. I hope so. I feel proud to have given that to a lot of people through various books of mine. And that is truly enough.
Oh, and you should be proud, because a writer does have the ability to touch someone in ways that other people can never do. So that is important. That's an interesting comment that you made about the solitary profession of writing, where you sit alone, a sort of spiritual awareness in your solitude, and yet you are almost a walking contradiction of that. I mean, you're a spectacular woman who is so graceful behind a microphone or a television camera or an interview. So it's almost, most writers, it would seem to me, would huddle quietly behind their computer screen and almost afraid to come out and talk. But you come out boldly and confront the world at the same time.
Well, I'm totally schizophrenic. What can I tell you? I'm really able to go away after I do the publicity stuff and I'm out in the world. I'm able to retreat and become very solitary for 3 years and work on my book. And I can make that transition from one to the other. I feel fortunate because I am also the fact that I'm a rather gregarious person who's interested in human beings gives me a lot more knowledge of the world. I like people. I like their life stories. I seldom sit down at a dinner party or on a plane without somebody telling me his or her life story. And so it feeds what I have to write about as well.
Well, I should hope so. If a writer doesn't have that inquisitive mind and want to draw people out, it would seem to me that you're going to be scraping at the bottom of the barrel for ideas. You mentioned Emily Dickinson, and your first book was Roots of Vegetables. That was poetry. And I believe your last book of poems was 1983.
1983. I have a new book of poems finished. You may have noticed that the publishing world has gone through a few gyrations in the last 10 years. They're not wildly over-eager to buy up volumes of verse and print them. I'm going to put together my new and selected poems, and I'm in the process of editing them now. The sad fact is that publishers are not publishing poetry in the way that they should. My new publisher is an exception. Harper & Row still publishes poetry and does very well with it. But many publishers have just eliminated their poetry lists. And the sad thing is, too, that even if a publisher prints a book of poetry, it's very hard to get it reviewed, noticed, attended to.
That's right.
So we need to go back to basics in the world of writing and publishing. We need to remember our wellspring, which is the word, which is poetry. And I think that after a decade of insane conglomerate madness, in which nobody wanted to publish anything but the memoirs of Donald Trump and Lee Iacocca and various conglomerateurs, good publishers are beginning to realize that they have to go back and publish real books again. I hope this will change in the 90s. I see some good little straws in the wind.
Poetry is tough, though, in many respects. You have to know the poet and be interested in the poet, because sometimes, and you may take exception to this comment, it's hard to tell good poetry from bad poetry. For example, a well-known a poet who publishes who writes a bad poem, that poem could well be read, if you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
But an unknown who writes a good poem may never be read because people don't know him and people don't care.
Well, Emily Dickinson's test still holds. If it makes the hair stand up on the back of your neck, it's a real poem.
Yeah, well, that's true. Well, I wanted to go back in Any Woman's Blues. There's this wonderful, wonderful scene that takes place in Philadelphia in Dart's Wasp family. It was so funny. Is that how you view Wasp, by the way?
Look, I reserve the right to make fun of everybody. Jews, Wasps, Blacks, you know, Chinese. And listen, I've been married to all of them. And so, or am all of them on some level. So I will make fun of everybody.
You know, the Columbus Day Parade marches up Fifth Avenue, and the Von Steuben Day Parade marches up Fifth Avenue, and the Puerto Rican Day Parade marches up Fifth Avenue. You know where the Wasp Parade marches, don't
no.
you? Across Fifth Avenue. Not too many wasps left in the world. Fanny, that was a historical novel, and Serenissima was too, in some respects, because at least Will Shakespeare was in there. Any chance you'll be going back to some more historical work?
Well, I've always got that desire to go back and write another historical novel. I also have in me a futuristic novel.
Uh-huh.
And I'm going to try everything if I have the time.
Amazon Women on the Moon? That would be a great title for a book, wouldn't it? Did you see the movie?
No, I
no,
didn't.
No, you ought to see it. It's a hilarious movie. It takes
No,
these,
I didn't see it.
What is purported to be old film clips of the 40s and 50s of serials and things like that. And one of the serials in the movie is Amazon Women on the Moon. You know, and it's, I don't know.
A great title. It's almost as good as Attack of the Killer Tomatoes.
That's very good, too.
A great title, but not a very good movie.
We're almost out of time. I did want to ask you, I was reading this article about you in Vanity Fair, and it was such a personal article. I just wondered how you felt about having so much of your personal life revealed in this article.
Well, fortunately, so much of it was incorrect.
I hope so. the reports of throwing up in parties and things like that.
Well, you'll have to ask Robert Redford. I never threw up on him. And that's very funny about Vanity Fair's article, because the throwing up, the fabled throwing up scene was reported without sources, without disclosed sources, you may remember. And in fact, the hostess of the party, Meredith Brokaw, denied that the incident ever occurred.
Oh, she said she didn't recall the incident.
Didn't recall, right. And nobody asked Robert Redford, who surely would have remembered if he had been thrown up on. In fact, I never threw up on Robert Redford, but I mean, even denying it makes me feel silly. I think there's a certain kind of journalism that is practiced at this time in this country, which people seem to like to read slatheringly, which says very unpleasant things about famous people. And it seems to sell magazines. And the fact-checking is not too responsible. And it's regrettable, because I consider journalism a very honorable profession. I'm a sometime journalist myself. I fact-check very carefully. I assume that famous people, that rumors always circulate about famous people who have controversial views, particularly. And I would never, in a profile I wrote about a celebrity, as I have done on occasion for various magazines, quote something without a source, because the assumption is celebrities, particularly celebrities with strong views, will have enemies. All people who are worth knowing have enemies. And therefore, I never quote something without quoting the source. It's unfortunate that the level of journalism to which I myself subscribe is not popularly subscribed to in the gossip press. And it's misleading for people. But in the end, I guess it helps the pot to boil. Because people find it fascinating.
Yeah, I
can't go around and refute all the false things that are said about me, and I'm a public person, so even though I'm married to a lawyer, I can't sue everybody, although I would like to.
But how's it? But here is quoting ex-husbands and former fathers-in-law and anonymous people. I mean, doesn't that make you feel that you're in a fishbowl? Or maybe some people like it. I mean, there
a
are
sewer.
There are people who pay Howard Rubenstein and other. John Scanlon and people like that, mm-hmm. a lot of money to get their names out there. And it would, you know, I would be, of course, I'm not a public person, but I would be shocked if something like that were written about me.
Well, initially, I found it very disturbing. I did find it very disturbing that there were so many falsehoods. But in the end, who remembers, you know? The record is full of falsehoods about every public person. And I guess someday when I'm 85, I'll have to write my autobiography and set the record straight.
I thought you already wrote it.
Not yet, no.
Erica, just to wrap things up, you mentioned you had a copy of Ulysses. Are you a rare book collector?
I am indeed.
Tell me about your collection.
Well, I have, I'm mad for books, as you know, and for poetry. And through the years, certain things have come into my hands. Because of my friendship with Henry Miller, I have a lot of autographed first editions of his and a lot of letters. I've been lucky enough to have a lot of correspondences with major writers of our time, like Henry Miller, like Anthony Burgess, like John Updike, like Anne Sexton. So I have a lot of letters from these people. My husband, Ken, gave me this first edition of Ulysses as an engagement present. Mm-hmm. I have some first editions of Colette. Ken collects because of he's a First Amendment nut and a passionate for radical literature. He collects everything about Sacco and Vanzetti and the Rosenbergs. And whenever I see a book that fits with his collection, I buy it for him. I just bought him a first edition of Emma Goldman's My Life, autographed by Emma. And we've decided, since we both have these books of all different types and descriptions in our collection. Oh, I have a first edition of Charlotte Bronte's first novel under the nom de plume Currer Bell.
Mm.
So I have a lot of first editions of important women writers, Colette, Charlotte Bronte, etc. But we've been trying to figure out a way that we can create a collection that has a kind of rhyme and reason behind it. And we've decided that we're both very interested in banned books, books that had a hard time making their way into the world. I also have a first edition of Lolita, Olympia Press. So we've decided to concentrate on, in what we buy in the future, banned books, books that were published in limited editions, destroyed, couldn't be published in their own country. The absolute summit of that collection would be, if we could ever find a copy, the book known as Q, or Shakespeare's Sonnets. Because everybody believes that above all that was a book that was suppressed, probably suppressed by the Earl of Southampton or his family, because it contained sonnets that seemed to be homosexual love poems between two men. And therefore, it is the rarest and most valuable book in the English language. And so far as I know, there's one in the Folger Library and one in the British Library, and I've never seen one anywhere on the market. So that would be the ultimate in owning a banned book. Maybe someday I'll have one.
Well, a collection like that would certainly have a wide academic interest, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would. But it's something that I love because I love books. I have a first edition of Measure for Measure. And as friends know that you love these things, whenever you have a birthday or an anniversary or for wedding presents and so on, they give you them. But it's fascinating to me because for me the book is a sacred, holy object.
Yeah. Well, tell me about your relationship with Henry Miller. I notice you have an epigraph by Miller at the beginning of Anywhere.
At the end of Miller's life, the last 10 years, he and I were friends. And he discovered Fear of Flying. He adored Fear of Flying. He never read his contemporaries. But with this particular book, he went crazy. Somebody forced it into his hand. I think it was Bradley Smith, the photographer. And Henry read it, and he said, "This is the female Tropic of Cancer." And he wrote me a fan letter. Then he wrote an op-ed piece in the Times saying, "This is a great book." By then, the book was unavailable everywhere because nobody had expected it to be a bestseller, and the hardcover publisher had only printed 30,000 copies. It was in no bookstores when Henry's piece appeared in the New York Times. It gained a kind of momentum by word of mouth. It was the book everyone had heard of and no one could find. When it came out in paperback, that was when it sold 6 million copies, in part because it had been so unavailable and so talked about. So it had a strange history. Henry Miller then sent Fear of Flying to friends all over the world. My French translator is the same as his French translator. My Japanese translator, various publishers all over the world took me up because of Henry. And Henry and I would sit together and he would describe his life in Paris and in the 30s. And I knew him very well as a pal, as a friend, as a mentor. But I knew him obviously only as a very old man. Nevertheless, he had this incredible magnetic vitality about him. He was a born storyteller. He was riveting. And even as a very old man, very infirm, wheelchair and bedridden, he could rivet you with his stories. He was incredible.
But he wasn't an influence on you as a writer.
He was an influence because his style is so incredibly liberating.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a breath of fresh air.
So he was one of your influences.
Mm-hmm.
Who were some of the other influences?
I think Colette is an important influence. Whitman is an important influence. Pablo Neruda is an important influence. Simone de Beauvoir, mm-hmm. an important influence. I think it's hard for women to be both intellectual and sexual at the same time. For French women, it wasn't. There is a dichotomy in Puritan countries between the mind and the body. French women writers were able to have active sexual lives and also active intellectual lives. And so in a way they form a better model than the Anglo-Saxon variety of writer. Those are some of the people who have been very important to me.
Well, Erica Jong, I really enjoyed Any Women's Blues, and I'm anxious to read the collected and selected poems when they're out. Always nice talking to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Don.